It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show, and happy Monday from the Radio Northwest Network, supplying honestly provocative talk radio for the Pacific Northwest. We have a lot to talk about today, and I'm glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. It is a pleasure to be with you today. I want to ask you a question. Now, this has to do with a law that does not exist. But one of the things we do here is ask about whether or not there should be laws occasionally. I'm not a guy who's the biggest fan of adding law after law after law, because for the most part, we have piles of laws that do not get enforced. But in some cases, I look at a situation and I wonder, how do you address this? It has to do with a woman who bought a car for her son. Now, her son, like many millennials, 24 years old, had no driver's license, although he apparently planned to get a driver's license. So mom goes down to buy him a car. Something else that I think at age 24, you ought to be buying your own automobile, but whatever. They bought it at a place called Car Hop. It is a place in the Seattle metro area. And when she bought the car, Michelle Taylor, her 24-year-old son still did not have a driver's license, but he planned to get one. He did not get one over the next month or so, but he apparently decided to drive the car anyway. And that's when the bad things happen. He hit a man, 60 years old, a well-known local architect, who was walking back to work from a visit, about the noon hour, I believe. And he hit the man so badly. The man lived, but he suffered a traumatic brain injury. He is still suffering from the after effects of that. And his family brought a lawsuit. And they essentially said, if you're going to buy a car, you should have to be able to have a license to drive the car. Now, I know that there are plenty of examples where somebody might have a need to buy a car, even though they are not going to drive it. You might buy a car for your business, and you might not be planning to drive the car yourself. Well, you'd have somebody else drive it. If you're older, you might buy a car so that a son or granddaughter could drive you around, even though you don't ever plan to be behind the wheel of the car. But what surprised me was this family sued the car dealership and said, you sold a car to a woman who told you this car was going to be used by her son. He had no driver's license, and he got no driver's license. And then while driving the car about a month later, he did all this damage to this 60-year-old architect that he is still suffering from today. The number in the lawsuit that surprised me was not the $5 million that they got in a settlement from the car dealership. The number that surprised me was this. This car place, Car Hop, sold 1,200 cars to people, and I love the way the Seattle Times describes this. Usually I call them the fish wrapper. But they described the people who had bought 1,200 cars from this place over the last 5 years who were not licensed at that time to drive. In other words, or who had no business driving. Meaning, they were both people who didn't have a driver's license and never had, like the 24-year-old man who hit the architect. They were also people, I would imagine, who were suspended, who had other kinds of driving infractions that should have kept them off the road. And you wonder, 1,200 cars over 5 years? That means that car dealership sold an average of one automobile for every business day of the week, Monday through Friday, for five solid years. Almost enough to say one every single day of the year. And you wonder, why are you selling so many cars to people who don't have any business driving? As I said, I think there are disabled people who might purchase an automobile even though they can't drive so that somebody else can drive the disabled person around. But 1,200 cars over 5 years? Does it strike you that perhaps some of the people who are buying the cars there are buying them because they don't have any business on the road? They've racked up a stack of DUIs, moving vehicle or motor vehicle infractions of one kind, or maybe they've even hurt or killed somebody. They no longer have the right to drive. But if you can buy the automobile without the driver's license, then who's to stop you? Well, the police will stop you perhaps eventually if they pull you over. But if somebody is driving without a license, how are you ever going to find them unless they get pulled over? In this case, this was nearly deadly for the victim in this accident in a hit and run where the 24-year-old hit him with the car that mom bought him and then ran from the scene of the accident, which is also a felony. So, as they say, Car Hop says they knew he didn't have a license. They knew that mom was buying this car for him. The company's attorney noted there are multiple reasons that somebody without a license might want to buy a car. You might want to purchase it for a caregiver or a child. But if somebody is going to drive the vehicle, Car Hop expects that person to have a license and insurance. So, should there be a law that requires you to have a driver's license to buy a car or to indicate at least that the person you're buying the car for has a valid license and has valid insurance? I'm glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. In Friday's Twitter poll, we asked you this. Should cities try to block rideshare services like Uber and Lyft in order to preserve the taxi industry? 95% of you agreed with me and said no to that idea. Only 5% said yes. And by the way, I'm going to tell you this story, and I'll tell it to you very shortly. I did some Twitter over the weekend about this story, and it involves a television news operation that I have a relationship with. I've done commentary for KGW, the NBC affiliate. But I woke up Saturday morning, and I read this story, and I thought, if I read through this whole story, what's the real story that's being told without the media bias? I would call this a great example of fake news by a young lady named Sarah Roth, who works for the digital side of KGW. So here's the headline for the story. A torture day by day. A mother's fight to reunify with her undocumented son in documents, court documents, detailing a family's journey to reunification show the federal government kept a mother and son apart for months longer than necessary, even before the zero tolerance policy. So you know they're going to mention Donald Trump. Does this have anything to do with Donald Trump? Here's the first part of the story. Months have passed, and with each passing day, I think it's less likely. The dream that any mother in my shoes would wait for. The time or day that her son finally gets home. That's the plea a mother of an undocumented Mexican teenager wrote in February of this year, 5 months after she learned that her son had crossed the border to find her. Well, that's where I got my first clue that this story was a little unusual. The story goes on to say, the family's fraught journey for reunification shows the federal government has kept parents and children separated for months longer than necessary, even before the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy took nearly 3,000 kids from their families at the border. And I thought, I get the whiff of some fake news in this. So I read through the entire story. It's a couple of thousand words long. And I finally did all the math on the ages and everything else. Here's my translation of what I think is a fake news story by Sarah Roth. Illegal alien mother abandons her 4-year-old son to a life of third world servitude a dozen years ago. She comes to the United States. She works illegally. She gets first world meds on the taxpayer's dime. Nearly adult son then enters illegally into the United States a dozen years later. 13 years apart by mom's choice is okay, but she says she's now tortured because the U.S. government has delayed being reunited with her illegal alien son. No objectivity there. Certainly a lot of bias there. And this is the kind of thing you have to watch for if you want to catch fake news. I think that piece of fake news is shameful. I think what they did was they took a select group of data. They put it together in a particular way that actually disguised the true nature of this. This woman left Mexico 13 years ago, and what she left behind was a 4-year-old boy. Now, you only get that if you do the math of when did she leave, how old is the kid today, how old would he would have been in 2005. Most parents of four-year-old children don't want to be separated from their child for more than a few hours or a few days, let alone simply leaving the kid behind to work as an agricultural worker on a farm while she comes to the United States, remakes her entire life, and leaves her kid in Mexico. So, as I said, 13 years of voluntary separation from your child, but you're on television blaming Donald Trump and the government for separating you because when your kid finally decided to do the same thing you did, cross into the country illegally, you're being kept apart for a few months. 13 years of voluntary separation is okay, but a few months of separation by the Trump administration is evil? This is part of the mainstream media's agenda to paint every situation that way. If this reporter, Sarah Roth, had said to the mother that she interviewed, if she had said, "Why did you leave your kid when he's 4 years old? Why did you leave him and never go back to him for 13 years?" And of course, they conveniently say, "We don't know whether or not she's a legal resident of the United States. I know to a fair certainty she's not." And how do I know that? Because if you're an American citizen and you have a child in another country, you can go to the immigration authorities. It's what they call family reunification laws in the United States that give American citizens a greater right to bring in family members, especially close family members like a son or daughter. She could have done that. She chose not to. She could have returned to Mexico. She chose not to. She could have tried all the other mechanisms to get her kid here. Instead, he does the same thing she does. Cross the border illegally, gets caught by the government, and then all of a sudden, Donald Trump holding up their reunification for a couple of months is awful, even though 13 years of voluntary separation is perfectly okay. Figure that one out and tell me that's not fake news. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, Oregon's medical marijuana program is a mess, according to the very state officials who are supposed to regulate the program. And now they admit they're not regulating it. How much pot is grown and distributed under the guise of medical need? The regulators say, we don't know. And why don't they know it? Well, they admit it's because the state is not doing inspections, and not surprisingly, the weed growers aren't reporting. If you know that the inspectors are never going to inspect, why would you bother reporting? They conclude that means an excess of pot is now being diverted into the hugely lucrative illegal weed market. The Oregon State Police reported that growers send as much as $1 billion worth of pot illegally out of the state into other states that have chosen not to legalize the weed. The Oregon Health Authority has the legal responsibility for oversight of the Oregon medical marijuana program. It estimates that there are 20,000 grow sites operating allegedly for medical pot, and they're supposed to be inspected. But the agency in charge of inspections did fewer than 100 inspections last year. Both the state's governor and its attorney general have received campaign cash from the weed growers. Does it surprise you that the state's attorney general and the governor aren't doing much of anything to actually insist on enforcement of the law?
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
Today's Daily Grill goes to the so-called transportation leaders who now say they may want to toll more than I-5 and I-205. They want to extend tolling to Highways 26, 217, I-405, on top of 5 and 205. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. John Harris says, Lars, I'm simply baffled by all this fuss about the Russian interference with the election when a major political party, the Democrats, interfered with their own nomination process. It seems much worse than the tampering that comes from inside than an external activity, signed John. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let me go first to Lorraine in Tacoma, listening on Talk Radio 570. How you doing, Lorraine?
I'm doing good. How are you, Lars?
Not so bad. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been an officer for 12 years. I specialized in arresting DUIs, and I think it would be fantastic if people who were suspended could not purchase a car, or if the insurance companies wouldn't pay on insurance for people who did allow people who were suspended to drive the cars. I've stopped numerous people who are suspended. I've had DUI drivers who have been suspended. And it's only a matter of time before it seriously, I mean, I'm sure it already has, but it'll hurt more people down the road.
Well, and that's the concern I've got, too. I understand the other reasons why people would buy a car who aren't even able to drive a car. Someone who's disabled, someone who's elderly, who's buying the car so that someone else can drive them around. I get all that, but I think there are ways that you could accommodate that while also saying, if you're buying a car and you don't have a license or a current license that's not suspended, we're not going to let you buy the car. And apparently, it sounds like this car dealership in particular, 1,200 cars sold to people who are not able to drive them over the last 5 years. That's over 200 a year. It's basically one every business day for the last 5 years. I have to believe that some of those are the people you end up picking up for further DUI.
Very true. And in fact, where some of these people get these cars, very shady business practices. I would hope that the AG would look into that, some of these businesses who are taking advantage of loopholes. And they're selling cars to make a quick buck. They don't really care who they're selling them to. They just want the money. And then these people, they get the cars, and then I get to deal with them later down the road, which it's fine. That's job security for me, but it's not very safe for everyone else.
Lorraine, stay safe out there and continue to maintain the thin blue line. Most of us out here really appreciate what you and your fellow officers do. Thanks for the call. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Lars Larson, always welcoming those who disagree.
Please welcome in no particular order. Naysayers.
Welcome, naysayers, to the Lars Larson Show.
Well, I started out today suggesting that there was a story about a woman who sued on behalf of her husband who was terribly injured when he was struck by a car. The driver of the car ran from the scene. He was apprehended, though. The driver was a 24-year-old who didn't have a driver's license, but whose mother bought him a car, even though her son didn't have a driver's license, and then he hit and ran. The car dealership has now settled for $5 million because of the damages done to the pedestrian who was hit. And I said, perhaps there should be a regulation that says you can't get a car if you don't have a license. And I got this email from Carl Cheney, who said, Lars, Car Hop is a national chain. My son and his girlfriend bought a car in Missouri. Neither one had a driver's license. They both got one shortly thereafter, but they should not have been able to buy. But Royce is a naysayer in Seattle, listening on KVI. Royce, welcome to the program, and what do you think about this?
Well, hey, Lars, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Glad to.
Yeah, big fan, listen to the show every day. But I don't agree with you that CarHop's got any liability in this.
Well, apparently CarHop thought they did because they paid $5 million.
Well, it sounds like they paid $5 million for hush money, just like any big corporation might. But it'd be like me selling you a pencil, not checking to see if you're a journalist to make sure that you're capable of owning a pencil. You give it to your kid stabs somebody in the eye with it, and then you come back and sue me because I sold you a pencil.
It may be like that, except that there is no pencil licensing, but there is car licensing. You cannot drive a car on the roads of the United States without having it registered and licensed and insured. All 50 states and the District of Columbia have that requirement. So comparing it to a pencil is a little off. Let me compare it to Let me compare it to a couple of other things. Do we license people who sell booze?
No, we license people who sell those.
Yes, and do we tell them?
We don't require people who buy those to have a license.
I didn't say that. But this is a different situation. It's another product where may somebody sell you booze when you are intoxicated?
No.
Why not?
Because people are idiots and they're going to do stupid stuff when they're drinking.
Do we let anybody who wants to buy dynamite?
No.
Why not?
Because it's a dangerous product and it requires proper handling.
Okay, so somebody wants to buy a car. All I'm saying is, should we know that that car is both the person who's buying it is actually licensed, like the dynamite buyer, and insured, like you have to insure a lot of different things. You can't buy a house without getting fire insurance, even though the average house is not going to burn down during the life of that mortgage. But they require it all the same.
That's not entirely true, Lars. If you go in and you buy a house with cash, you're not required to have anything.
Well, that's true.
The only reason why you're required to have insurance in this case is to protect the lender who's letting you use their money to buy that house.
Is somebody able to buy a gun if they're not legally qualified to own the gun?
That's a dangerous slope. There,
no,
Lars.
It's not dangerous. Hold on. It's not dangerous at all. Can a gun store in America sell a gun to a 12-year-old?
Absolutely not.
Can you sell to a convicted felon?
Absolutely not.
Can you sell to a man who beats his wife and got caught beating his wife by the police?
No.
Okay. Now, why do we put that restriction on? Because it's problematic to sell a gun to somebody who's a convicted felon, or somebody who beats his wife, or someone who's 12 years old. In this case, this woman bought a car. She told the dealership, I'm buying it for my son. And then she drove it off the lot because she had the license. She somehow allowed this car into the hands of her son. And the argument was made, apparently successfully, when you say $5 million in hush money, if you really truly believe you had no liability, you wouldn't pay a dime, would you?
Well, I probably wouldn't, but so what you're saying is that she's a straw buyer on the car and that she should be going to jail because she allowed her son to potentially kill somebody.
See, and that's I don't know that I extend that far, but I think when I read that this dealership hasn't sold one or two cars to people who have no business on the roads, because that includes
if we're going to talk numbers, what we're talking are is a multinational or a national conglomerate that sells tens of thousands of cars daily.
But at that lot, they have sold 1,200 cars in the last 5 years to people who were either suspended or had no license whatsoever. Now, that seems like a large number. That's basically 250 cars a year for 5 years, or 200 cars a year for 5 years. It's one car every day. Almost every day, that lot sells a car to somebody who has no license or a suspended license. Does that raise your suspicions at all about why so many unlicensed people are buying cars from that lot, from that company?
I bet you if you looked at all of the car lots across the entire state, you would find that every car lot sells cars to anybody who walks in with cash, because that there's no law saying that.
And my question is, would it be reasonable to say if you want to buy a car and it's for you, then you need to show a driver's license? And if you're buying it and you walk in and say, I'm buying this for my son, does your son have a driver's license? Nobody's going to get one. That was the car lot's argument. Well, he was going to get one. Well, he didn't get one, but he did hit a pedestrian and do tremendous damage to this man. There was a point where his family thought he was going to die. He's lived, but he has.
I think this kid should be held accountable. I think mom should be held accountable. I don't see where the lot is accountable here. If I was to buy a gun and I handed it to my son and he went and murdered somebody with it, I would expect that I would be in jail for a long time.
By the way, can I tell you what our wonderful restorative justice system did to this young 24-year-old? So he's been an adult for 6 years.
He got a car.
He got a car. He drove it illegally. He hit a pedestrian and did tremendous damage to the man, and then left the scene of the accident, which by itself is a serious crime in every state in America. Yeah. He got 1 year of work release.
Oh, my gosh.
1 year. So when you talk about being, and see, to some extent, I agree with you, but I'm trying to get at the source of this problem. When you heard the police officer, Lorraine, call in right before the bottom of the hour, she said, look, I'm picking these people up all the time. So we wonder, how the heck does somebody who's got all these DUIs, all these moving infractions, doesn't have a license, doesn't have insurance, doesn't have any of this, how in the world are they getting cars? It sounds like we have an industry that is supplying them with cars, and I'm asking, what would be the reasonable way for that industry? Or I would rather see a private sector solution to this. So if you can suggest one, I'd love it if all the car dealers got together and said, we're not selling you a car unless we know that the person we're being told is going to drive that car has insurance and a license, and a valid license at that.
But it still doesn't, it won't fix nothing, because whoever drives the car off the lot is going to hand the car over to whoever.
Well, and then maybe what we do is your straw man, or your straw suggestion was a good one. If I go and buy a gun and I hand it to somebody who's not qualified to buy a gun, I've just committed a federal crime. That one also gets punished lightly, but it should be punished in a very tough way. But if mom puts the car in the hands of her kid and he goes out and hurts somebody with it, should mom face a penalty?
Absolutely.
I would think so, too. And if somebody says, well, what about guns? I would say if an adult knowingly puts a gun in the hand of a child and the child hurts somebody with that gun, should there be a penalty on the adult as well as the child? I think absolutely true. Actually, Royce is a great naysayer. So hold on for a second, Royce. Will you pick up that line, guys, right now? Here's what we're going to start doing. You've heard me talk about the Lars Challenge coin. We've initiated something brand new. I got the challenge coins put together because I wanted to make sure that we had something give back to the veterans and the active duty members who've given us challenge coins over the years. So we created the Lars Larson Show Challenge Coin. You can find it on the website. You can see a picture of there. In fact, we just dropped the price. They're made by veterans in Georgia. We're going to give away one of those every single week to the best naysayer of the week. And Royce just won it for this week. So we get his name and his address and all the rest of that. Not everybody uses their real name on the air, and we understand why. We like naysayers, and we even like Democrats calling the show, and liberals and progressives, and sometimes they don't want to use their own name. So Royce becomes the first winner of a Lars Larson Show Challenge Coin, and I'll be back in just a moment. Live on the Radio Northwest Network, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to ask you this question, not entirely rhetorically, but a story out of the Seattle Times Fish Wrapper about a man who was a teaching assistant in the public schools. And he kept his job despite having all kinds of problems. I'll describe those in a moment. Now he has been accused of raping a child, a 9-year-old boy. Now imagine this. This guy, according to the Times, missed work 21 times, routinely showed up late or reeking of alcohol, disrupted the class. He was a teaching assistant. With loud outbursts, even one time, quote, playfully putting a special needs student with impulse control issues into a headlock. Seattle Public Schools kept Albert Verachesmith, a man who would later be accused of child rape, working as an instructional assistant at John Muir Elementary School during the 2016-17 school year, pairing him off with a special education student who needed extra help. In fact, they write, only after Verachesmith showed up smelling of booze yet again at the end of that school year did the district try to fire him. But that didn't stick. And you know why? Because of the unions. Remember when we had James O'Keefe from Project Veritas on, and they had done secret recordings, you know, video recordings and audio recordings of union bosses who represented teachers saying, hey, we don't care if the teacher's guilty of doing things to kids. We defend them because that's what we, the union, do. Well, Verachesmith sounds like exactly that kind of situation. After the district tried to fire him for the things I just mentioned, he and his union, the Seattle Education Association, filed a grievance challenging his termination, and the district agreed to a compromise that allowed him to keep working with kids as a substitute during the 2017-18 school year, the one that just ended. Within 2 months, Verachesmith had violated what was called the Last Chance Settlement Agreement by failing 2 urinalysis tests and repeatedly missing required alcohol treatment sessions. Still, the district held off on firing him. Why? Because they're afraid of the union. Last school year, Viracha Smith subbed at 7 different schools, 5 of them after his violations came to light, until January 29th, when a 9-year-old told his parents about the 5 or 6 times that Viracha Smith allegedly sexually assaulted him inside a bathroom at the elementary school during the previous year. Now, he has a right to his day in court. But do you want your kids cared for by a school system that constantly demands more money and can't even fire bad apples like that? You miss work, you show up smelling like booze, you're given a last chance settlement agreement that says you got to have regular testing for alcohol, you show up smelling like booze, you fail those tests, and now you're accused of raping a child, a 9-year-old boy, 5 or 6 times. Boy, what an ugly situation. Let's go to naysayer Jesse. Hey, Jesse, welcome to the program. What's on your mind? You heard me telling the story about the settlement in the case where the mom bought her son a car, even though he had no driver's license. And a month later, he runs a man down in a crosswalk and then runs from the scene. What do you think?
Correct. I heard that. But I guess my point is, there's plenty of kids out here, like including myself, that was when I was about 12 years old, I was out, you know, mowing lawns, making money.
Yeah.
Making money. I bought my first Toyota when I was about 15 years old. And it wasn't, you know, running quite right. There was a couple issues with it, this and that. But at 15, I had other buddies that were over 16. They came over, helped me fix it. When I turned 16 years old, I got that Toyota running. I was on the road at 16 with my own vehicle. And I was able to get a better job. Now, if I was never allowed to buy that because I was not 16, I didn't have a license then, I wouldn't have had that opportunity.
Well, all you'd have had to do, correct me if I'm wrong, you mowed all those lawns, you had the money to get the car. You could have waited till you got your license, then you go down and buy the car, and yes, you might have had to wait a little while you worked on making the car run right. But in the meantime, let me guess that while you were under 16 and your friends were over 16, you did go driving around with them at the wheel. Right?
At times, yes, but I could not have got the job I got when I was 16 without that.
Hold on. Hold on. You couldn't have got the job without having a car that you couldn't drive?
No, once I turned 16.
Well, I'm missing something. You said you couldn't have got the job without what?
Without the car. So if I was when I was 16, if I didn't have a car ready that I had been working on, prepared...
But you'd already been working a number of jobs up to 16 without the car,
correct.
Right? To make the money to buy it.
Exactly. Pushing a little mower
Fine.
Around.
You know what I would do in that case? I would say, we're going to turn the car over to a licensed insured driver. So you can sell it to a licensed insured driver. But that driver needs to know that if you let that car into the hands of the kid, you in this case, or this guy, this 24-year-old who didn't even have a driver's license, then any accident that is caused is on the parent or the legal adult who's got the driver's license. Yeah. Is that a reasonable way to address it?
But I guess my point is you don't punish the guy that's done nothing wrong. You punish the individual that has done something. So the guy that did do something wrong, the 24-year-old, he should be prosecuted and be charged with whatever.
He was, and he got a year of house arrest for running a man down and basically ruining the man's life. He can't. But did the car dealership participate in that? Apparently, they thought so. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. Our Twitter poll today, should the law require you to have a driver's license to buy a car? You can vote in the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com, two places, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Service. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right online at ultimatetruckservice.com. And as I said on Friday, we ask you this question: should cities try to block rideshare services to preserve the local taxi industry? Lane County and Eugene are talking about that right now and patting themselves on the back, while other more sensible cities have said, we understand this is the latest evolution in personal transportation. We're going to let there be competition instead of a state or city operated monopoly called the cab industry. I'd be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. But first, I want to introduce you to Nolan Ashby, who is the owner and operator of a rug cleaning company in Milwaukee. I got no dog in the fight because I haven't used Mr. Ashby's services, but I'm not here to talk to him about cleaning rugs. I want to talk to him about the governor of the state of Oregon. Mr. Ashby, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So tell me about this. You think that you have been improperly portrayed in the press when there were stories written about a week ago talking about threats that had been made to Governor Kate Brown. What happened on that day before Thanksgiving 2015, about 2.5 years ago, when you showed up at Governor Kate Brown's home?
Well, would you like to hear the story, how it all happened? I could start from the...
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. What happened?
Yeah. Well, I was about 3 years ago in 2015. I was taking some sleeping pads to some homeless people just so they could sleep on them. The temperatures were in their 20s the night before, and I knew of this homeless camp in a park near a building that I worked at. And so I was giving out the pads, and then I asked if there was any veterans there. And then when Daryl Snook said, yes, I'm a veteran, and I said, asked him if I could do a better video interview with him. During the interview, we talked about the vet situation and being homeless and stuff. And in the heat of the moment, I guess, I said, well, how would you like to talk to the governor about that? I will take you to her home, and we'll knock on her door and ask her what's going to be done about it.
Fair enough.
And so he agreed to do it, and so we drove to her house. I walked up to the door with Daryl Snook, knocked on the door, and immediately a protection officer came up to the porch, and we went over and spoke to him, and politely and respectfully, and he asked us what we wanted, and we just said we wanted to talk to the governor about the veteran situation of homelessness in Portland. And he said that she was not available and that he would take our names and numbers and she would contact us. And so I gave her my name and my phone number. So did Daryl Snook. And we went on our way. And then about 3 weeks later, a couple of the dignitary task force for the governor were in front of my house when I came home, and they asked if they could speak to me. And so we came into my home, and they said they were there to talk about me, my visit to the governor's house. And so they told me of the accusations that Daryl Snook had made about me. And, you know, I answered all their questions honestly. And they said that the accusations, they did not believe them, that they needed to verify and talk to me about them.
Well, let's not leave this out. What did Daryl Snook, your homeless buddy, what did he say you had said?
Well, at that time, they told me that I, he had said to them that I was there to blow up her house. And that kind of caught me off guard. That is not what my intentions were.
Well, let me ask you something. Did you say anything at all in your interactions with this homeless guy that would lead him to believe that you planned to blow up the governor's house?
Absolutely not. All, all we talked about was his service in Vietnam, and we talked about the situation of other people in the parks and stuff, and that's all I was planning on talking about, and that was it.
Was this, Daryl, let me ask you something. Some of the people who are on the streets are relatively coherent and lucid, for lack of a better term, and some of them are pretty crazy. Which category do you think Daryl Snook fit into?
Before or after?
Well, I'm saying when you first interacted with him, did he seem like somebody who's relatively sane?
Yeah, he spoke clearly, and he spoke about the issues rationally. And so I had no reason to believe that he wouldn't do so. And if he hadn't, I would not have taken him there. And I did record it. And
you recorded the visit to the governor's house?
I recorded our interview at the park where I mentioned what we were going to go talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was it.
What do you think brought him? What do you think caused him to say that to the investigators?
I really don't know. It really caught me off guard.
I mean,
to do is help.
Were you sideways with him in some way? Did he get angry at you about something, and that would have caused an otherwise sane guy to tell the state police that you were planning to blow up the governor's house?
No. After we went to the governor's house, I drove him back to the park, and we never spoke again.
Hmm.
And, you know, I gave him some money to get something to eat, and I gave him a sleeping pad to sleep on so he de-insulated from the ground. I really don't know why somebody would, you know, you're trying to help and bring attention to their problem. I have no idea.
All right, what ended up happening out of the investigation by the state police where they came to you and said, this guy says you want to blow up the governor's house. How did that all end?
Well, they went and did a check on me, background check. They interviewed people that I knew and to find out a little bit about me, what kind of mental state I was in, which I guess they had some questions about, with those kind of accusations. And everything that I told the officers was verified, you know, and they didn't find anything. And I was never charged with anything. They never told me that I was going to be charged with anything. In fact, they said that Daryl Snook was going to be charged with making a false testimony and false report. And that I shouldn't have any more contact with him, which I did not.
Sounds like a good idea.
I have not had contact with him.
But you think you've now been misportrayed because of this when the stories were done about threats toward Governor Brown?
Yes. Well, they took the accusations of Daryl Snook out of a police report and made it seem like those were valid, and there was no evidence that I did any of that. I was open with the police officers. They checked into me, and as far as I knew, until last week, that it was all under the bridge, all water under the bridge.
And then you find yourself back in the news again.
Yeah, 3 years later.
Well,
and it's really, it's really caused a lot of problems, you know, in the family. I had to call my mom and tell her there was going to be some awful things coming out about me, and she knew the situation, and she was proud of what I did, and I really,
Because walking up to somebody's house, even a public official, and knocking on the door and politely asking to speak to them, there's nothing wrong with that. Any American citizen can do that.
No, and I, to the officers, I can see how it was seen. And I apologized for my bold actions. And that's all I would describe them as. It was bold. But that's how you get attention to things. You do it respectfully but boldly. And I didn't do anything wrong.
It doesn't sound like it. Mr. Ashby, thanks very much. I appreciate your time. Back in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and your emails. It's Monday on the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, our Twitter poll and the story about the Seattle area car dealership that is part of a national chain that just settled a $5 million settlement with the wife of a man who was hit in a crosswalk, terribly injured, suffered brain damage and other things, couldn't go back to work as an architect, and the driver of the car that hit him also ran from the scene, which is a crime. And I said, the fact that this dealership in 5 years has sold 1,200 vehicles to people who either have a suspended license or no license whatsoever made me ask, how could we stop that kind of thing? And then hearing from Lorraine, the Seattle area police officer, who called in to say she's constantly stopping people who have no business driving. They're suspended or revoked driver's licenses, no insurance, drunk or under the influence. And I said, well, how do you fix this? Debbie writes in, Lars, I purchased two vehicles, both from for each of my daughters. They were both bought before the age of 16 so that they could learn their driver's permit in that car. Then the dealership should have a disclosure stating that if you allow somebody without a license to drive your vehicle, then you are responsible for it. Let's go first to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, Lars, how are you doing? It's been a long time listening to you.
Thank you.
And I'm actually local here in the Portland area, actually up on the Washington side, so the better part of the river. But I work in the insurance industry, and it's something that I work with every single day. And I think the point when you started talking about a potential for laws to be passed,
or a private sector solution. I'm all for private sector solutions, if you can.
Correct.
Think of
one. Well, for me, the big issue that we are constantly battling in government is personal property rights. Why is it the government's responsibility to tell us what we can buy and why? And
well,
when,
Chris,
or why, or
the
why
short,
not?
The short answer to that is personal property in general, I don't think the government should. But when you have personal property that is a vehicle driven on the public roads, that's a different thing, isn't it?
To a point, but don't you also have the right to tow the vehicle without driving it?
You do.
Don't you have the right to own the vehicle without driving it?
Yes. I covered that at the beginning. I said there will be people who buy a vehicle who can never drive it. Somebody who's a quadriplegic, right, may buy a vehicle so that someone else can drive the quad, in his vehicle, but he buys the vehicle and then has somebody else drive it for him. I understand that, but I'm not talking about that. We could figure out solutions for those kinds of situations, but should a car lot be selling a car to somebody who has no valid license?
Well, the question to that is the same question we've been asking about firearms. Is it the firearm's fault or is it the person's
fault?
No,
but I'm not suggesting, but I accept that there are regulations on who you can sell a firearm to. If I went and did the firearms equivalent of what this woman did, I'd have committed a federal crime. If I went out and bought a firearm, because I have a clean record, and I supplied it to somebody who can't legally own the firearm, and I bought it for them, that kind of straw purchase sends people to prison, period.
It's now, called a straw the young purchase. Man put, the question I had was the young man put on the title and registered?
He was apparently not, but the car dealership apparently understood. We're buying the car for this young man. He was 24 years old, so he's certainly old enough to sign a contract. But the mom bought the car, but she indicated, I'm buying the car for my son. He doesn't have a license yet, but he's planning to get one. And apparently the car dealership thought it's exposure when it was sued because of what was done to this man who was hurt by the young man driving the car, was enough that they were willing to settle for $5 million. That is not a nuisance amount of money, is it?
Well, I mean, that's irrelevant of what they're
no,
willing
it's,
to settle
it's,
for because
it's
there's
not.
Also, well, there's
Hold on. There are settlements. There are settlements for $500. When you have a slip and fall in a grocery store, they settle those all. You know, they settle those regularly for $500 or $1,000. But if you say the grocery store settled for $1 million, that's not a nuisance settlement where you say it's cheaper to pay $1 million than it is to go to court. I'll tell you what, you can buy a lot of lawyer time.
With the loss of a life, though, that's a different scenario.
Yeah, he didn't
the
die.
Image of fighting
he didn't
a
die.
Family just, with the loss of a life would be a big difference.
Yeah, except but
my point is even with the firearms piece, even with the firearms piece is, you know, there's lots of people that buy a .22 rifle for their 8-year-old kid.
Can't
to learn
legally,
how to
not
rifle.
Legally. And that person who buys the gun is responsible for it. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails, but I've really been looking forward to this for a while. Officer Daryl Turner is the president of the Portland Police Association, and he represents the people, the men and women in blue, who are out there on that thin blue line between civilization and all of the folks out there who would commit crimes. And Daryl wrote in a release that came out today, "Our city has become a cesspool. Livability that once made Portland a unique and vibrant city is now replaced with human feces in business doorways, in our parks, and on our streets. Aggressive panhandlers block the sidewalks and the storefronts and landmarks like Pioneer Square, discouraging people from enjoying our city. Garbage-filled RVs and vehicles are strewn throughout neighborhoods. Used needles, drug paraphernalia, and trash are common sights lining the streets and sidewalks, under our bridges and freeway overpasses. That's not what our families and business owners and tourists deserve." Daryl, I couldn't agree with you more, and thanks for writing that letter, and welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Lars.
In fact, it kind of echoes the comments of the new mayor of San Francisco, and I was as surprised as anybody to find that this brand new mayor came out and complained that her city has more, you know, human waste on the streets than she's ever seen before, and she's outraged by it. And I think for San Francisco, you have to have some pretty bad circumstances before people get outraged because their sense of political correctness usually overrides their common sense. But in this case, she's speaking out against it. What is it you see as the proximate cause and the person, the one person who could make this situation change?
Well, I don't think there's a one person that can make this situation change. I think it's several people. I think it's a lot of our electeds. But I think the main problem is we are a lot of failed policies, failed policies by our mayor, failed policies by other elected officials. For years and years and years, they have been taking tens of millions of taxpayer dollars and throwing them down a black hole. And these policies haven't worked. These ideas haven't worked. And we continue to take taxpayer money to do this. And as we can see, anybody who's been in Portland any amount of time, I've been a Portland police officer for 27 years here, the city is going downhill, and it's going downhill pretty quick.
And to add to that, they're not just benignly neglecting the city into this kind of state. They're actually, the mayor in this case, is actually attacking your officers by saying there's a problem with the idea that while homeless represent 1 or 2 or 3% of the population, they actually account for more than 50% of the arrests, and he somehow makes that out to be the fault of police officers. What do you say to that?
Well, number one, I think his uninformed knee-jerk reaction to an Oregonian article, instead of supporting the work that the men and women, the rank and file of the Portland Police Bureau do, and admitting that these policies have failed and that the direction has failed, he wants to put the burden on somebody else's shoulders. I think, number one, the thing we need to be doing is enforcing the laws of everyone across the board. If we're arrested, 52% of our arrests in the last year or so have been of homeless people, that means most of those victims are homeless people, too. We also have to look at who are the victims of these crimes. But if they're residents, if they're business owners, or they're tourists, whoever they may be, if crimes are committed, it doesn't matter by who, and we have to arrest people, we have to write citations, whatever we have to do that. There's alternatives for certain people that we can say, you're going to be arrested, you're going to be cited, but if you go into the programs, if you take advantage of the resources that we have out there for the homeless, for people with addiction issues, then we can, you know, we can say this is what you need to do to get yourself on the right track.
But what we're doing, or what the city leaders are doing, are enabling people to feel entitled to be able to urinate and defecate in doorways, to lay out on the sidewalks and block the sidewalks so that people can't get by and actually have to step around them or cross the street. My own wife works downtown, and she's been called every name in the book for not giving money to some of the panhandlers downtown, to where, to the point where she basically eats her lunch in her office every day. And this is not just one person. This is several Portlanders who work downtown who no longer go outside to the park to sit on a bench and eat, no longer go out to Pioneer Square, or just take a walk in Waterfront Park on their lunch breaks anymore.
Do you think the mayor's playing political favorites?
I don't know about political favors, but to say that police officers are maybe profiling or implicit bias towards homeless people, I think that's irresponsible of him to do that. I think he needs to take a look at what's going on out there. I think he needs to be realistic about what's going on out there and try to make policies that are realistic. Go to the people who are out there every day on the street and ask them what they think. Go to the neighborhoods and talk to the residents. And those are the things that need to be done, because the policies don't seem to be working, and we're going downhill quick, and we can't continue this. Give the police bureau the resources we need to be able to do the job that we're sworn to do.
Of course, you could have all the resources in the world, but if the mayor ties your hands, if he says, for example, and when I said political favorites, I had two thoughts in mind. One is the group called Antifa. It strikes me that the mayor's rules of engagement for the officers you represent are don't do anything about them until they start breaking a lot of things or setting a lot of things on fire, like police cars and storefronts. The mayor has said, don't do anything at all about the lawless behavior by the group that is trying to shut down the ICE office, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The mayor apparently agrees with Antifa, and he apparently agrees with the protesters who want to shut down ICE, and he's told your officers don't enforce the law. Am I wrong?
Well, I will say this, that it is illegal for us not to respond to 911 calls. If we get 911 calls, we are supposed to respond. And I have not personally heard him say that. I don't know if he said that. I do know that for the frustration for us is we do get mixed messages from City Hall, and we need, you know, direction. And that direction would be to enforce the laws of the city and the state and the county.
Yeah, and the reason he doesn't have to say it out loud, all he has to do is, correct me if I'm wrong, pick up the phone and call Chief Outlaw. And when she says, what do you want us to do about this ICE office? And he says, let them do what they're doing till they start hurting somebody or breaking or burning something. And if he tells her that, then she sends the orders down through the chain of command. She doesn't have to say, the mayor told me to do this. She just says, this is how we're going to respond. So the mayor can do this behind closed doors and in closed channels of communication that nobody else can get access to. Am I wrong?
And, you know, I don't know what the conversations were between the chief and the mayor, or if there were any conversations. I do know the mayor needs to be held accountable for his words. I do know that the words he spoke to the Oregonian on Friday regarding police officers and their contact with the homeless was wrong. I know he'll go out and say, well, you know, Darrell, I say a lot of good things about police officers. Well, you can't say good things and then slap us in the face also. That doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way anywhere, and it won't work that way here. And so we're going to speak out when he speaks out and remind him that who's out there doing the work every day, remind him that this is the work the citizens want done. And that's why when he goes to neighborhood association meetings and when he goes to business association meetings, they're constantly talking to him about the livability issues in this city and how it's gone downhill, how the police officers are working hard, but we don't seem to have the resources, including the staffing, to be able to handle all these issues, and that he as the mayor and as the police commissioner should be at the forefront of trying to solve these problems instead of trying to throw the burden on the shoulders of somebody else who they haven't given the resources and the ability and the staffing to be able to take care of these issues.
Darrell, do you think that the officers should be allowed to go down and enforce the law against the people who are trying to, who have the stated intent to shut down ICE?
What I can say, Lars, is that if we get 911 calls, we need
to respond. No, but don't dodge that way.
It's not dodging. What I'm doing is I'm capsulizing. We're not just talking about specific instances, but all instances, whether it be a segment of the homeless population, a segment of protesters, wherever it may be, we're supposed to be able to respond to 911 calls and take the actions we need to take to keep citizens safe and keep the public safe.
What's it telling your officers when they're effectively told don't enforce the law?
Well, it's confusing because that's our job, is to enforce the law. Obviously, there's always a gray area, but the gray area is the area that we have to be able to use when we're in that situation and not somebody who's looking from it at a 20,000-foot level.
Now, see, the mayor doesn't seem to have a handle on policing of the city, which is his job under the charter. And yet today I saw him being written up because he's got some new ideas on how to run the schools. Last time you checked the city charter, is there anything in there about the mayor running the schools?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, not to my knowledge either. I've read the thing front to back. Anything else that the public should know about this, Daryl?
I would just ask the public to call the mayor's office. Let them know about the livability issues they see out there every day, and let him know about what they want done about it, because I think if he gets the phone calls, he gets the emails, he gets the text messages, he'll understand that the citizens are frustrated about the livability issues, as police officers are frustrated about not being able to enforce all the laws about the livability issues. And to stop using us as the scapegoat to smokescreen our citizens about failed policies.
Daryl, it's a pleasure as always. Keep up the good work at the Portland Police Association. And I say that, even though you probably know that I'm not the biggest fan of unions in the world, but I think you perform an important function here, because I know the individual officers can't exactly speak out on this, but you can.
All right. Thank you very much, Lars.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to have you on. That's Daryl Turner from the Portland Police Association, the union that represents police officers. Back in just a moment, we'll get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Andy writes in, Lars, I'd be willing to bet there are numerous noise complaints have been called into 911 by residents of the condos across the street from the ICE office, but Ted Wheeler will not let his officers respond. So, to your calls now. Let me go to, let's go to Kathy in Bellingham. Kathy, thanks for listening on KGMI. What's on your mind on this nice Monday in the Northwest?
Hi, Lars. Well, I don't like the idea of the government putting the burden and liability on car dealerships, and because where does it end? It's just like I always thought a good idea for sex offenders was that they could never, particularly if they used a car or a van in the process of their crime, that they could never have a driver's license or a car, because they use that in facilitating that crime, just like if you used a gun in robbing a bank or something. But so, I mean, I think that would be a good idea, but I don't think the burden should be on the car dealers to take care of criminals or bad parenting.
Do you mind if I push back on that a little bit?
Okay.
Are you concerned when you buy a car, if it's a used car, how many miles are on it?
Yes.
Okay. You know who checks to make sure that when a car comes in that the number of miles is recorded so that when it's sold, nobody's rolled the odo back? Who does that?
The dealership?
The dealership does it. And when the dealership is asked, are you selling this car to somebody who has insurance for the car before they drive off the lot? I know that technically the dealership is on the hook for the first little bit when you drive a car away. And if you already have car insurance in place, you can call your insurance person that night or the next day, and it's usually enough. You're covered. But would it be nice if we knew that cars weren't being sold to people unless that person had insurance for the car before they go out on the highway and go 60 miles an hour in a 5,000-pound vehicle? And if not them, then who's going to make sure of that?
Well, people could get fake ID. There's criminals are going to be criminals, and I'm tired of law-abiding citizens having to go the extra mile in inconvenience because there's some criminals out there.
If you could persuade me there is inconvenience, but Kathy, have you bought a car recently?
Yes.
How inconvenient was it for you to pick up your purse, dig out your wallet, and hand them your driver's license? In fact, I'm willing to bet the car dealership you bought it at ask you for that anyway, right?
Right, they do.
So how inconvenient is that?
But I don't think the liability should be on the car lot, that if somebody isn't honest with them, and no crime has been committed.
No, well, in this case, there was a crime committed. The car dealer.
After the fact.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree with you after the fact.
That was bad parenting.
I agree with you. I agree with you there, too.
There's not a law against that, too bad.
No, but I'm not curious so much about this 24-year-old who hit the man, because I know what happened there. And in that case, the car dealership and their lawyers apparently decided they did have liability, which is why they settled out for $5 million. What I was more concerned about, and I mentioned this when I first launched this topic, is that that car dealership has sold 1,200 cars in the last 5 years to people who are not able to drive legally. Now, they didn't go into the breakdown of how many of those were suspended drivers, how many were revoked drivers, that sort of thing. But I have to believe it wasn't all just parents buying cars for their kids. Go ahead.
Did they have fake IDs?
They had real IDs because when they checked to see who is this car dealership selling to, they were selling to a lot of people who are not licensed to drive. They either didn't have a license, it had been suspended, or it had been revoked. So in that case, you know who the person is because how else would you know somebody's revoked than by looking up their background? You know, saying, does this person have the right to drive? And you say, no, he's suspended or he's revoked.
You can look up their criminal record, I guess. But at the same time, okay, so maybe this is a bad company. So why should this bad company then put all this more burden and red tape and liability onto the honest
person? Isn't it always bad companies and bad individuals that cause laws to be written that inconvenience the rest of us? For the most part, all of them. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails all over the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative talk radio. And how can you participate? Well, we make that easy. You want to join the best conversation in talk journalism? It's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. You can answer our Twitter poll. Should the law require you to have a driver's license to buy a car? One case that we've been talking about today involves somebody who bought a car for her son. He did not have a driver's license, but he was planning to get one at the ripe old age of 24. He did not. He took the car out about a month later, ran a man down in a crosswalk, did tremendous damage to a 60-year-old architect who is now no longer able to work, and he suffers from ongoing problems because of the damage done to him in that accident. And then the young man ran from the scene of the crime. And what terrible punishment did he get? A year of house arrest. A year of work release. So that's it for felony hit and run and leaving the scene of an accident, doing all that damage to the man. One of the big concerns I've had over the years here in the Northwest is that my wife and I have bought a couple of different houses, go from one house to another house, like many people do. The last house we've been in for 14 years, and we bought it from an orthodontist, so I don't think we had to worry that he was running a meth lab. But imagine what you do if you bought a house and you found out it had previously been a meth lab. Travis Tubbs joins me now. Travis, thanks a lot for sending me an email about this and alerting me to your family's situation. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. I appreciate your time and your willingness to take the story up because I'm kind of at a loss at what else to do next. And so I really appreciate you taking this time.
Glad to do it. Now, I want you to explain to my audience just how dire your situation is. How long ago, and just do these questions as I go, how long ago did you buy the house?
So we bought it a year ago. We actually are about 9 days past the closing date. So we bought it over a year ago now, and we have yet to actually live in the house.
And that's because you're now living in a converted garage on the property. Is that right?
So we actually sleep in a little trailer. So we bought a trailer. We got a little camper and pop-up trailer. That's where the wife and I and seven kids are sleeping. And then we had one of the outbuildings was a four-car garage that it was just a makeshift old barn. It used to be a chicken coop in some previous life of this building. And we had to get it cleaned from all the meth contamination. But once it was cleaned, I retrofitted it as best I could, as quickly as I could. So we at least had a place where we could function as a family and sit down and eat together as a family. Because up until then, we were living in these two little trailers with as you can imagine, seven little kids, it gets pretty tight real quick.
Now, let me ask you a couple of questions because I'm going to jump around in the story a little bit because I think there are things people need to know first. First, they might wonder, Well, but did the owners or did the real estate agent who arranged the sale have any reason to know that it was a meth lab? The one of the real estate agents in this case was a co-owner of the house. Is that right?
That is correct. So there are two owners in this case, and one was living there, and the other one was the other owner was the real estate agent who sold us this.
All right. And so that person, and was that person ever put on notice legally by the police or others that this had been a meth lab?
So as far as I can tell, he was never officially notified. There was no evidence of official notification. There was definitely some other police reports and stuff like that. But this is something that this is part of the problem is I didn't know any of this coming into it. And it was never disclosed to us.
Right. And that's what I'm getting at. I just want to lay the foundation. So there were police reports that indicated this had been the site of a meth lab, right?
The police reports indicated that there was activity, the illegal activity. It just never came out and said what it was. It didn't say drugs or anything like that. We've learned later that the police well knew that this was.
Okay.
But never, there was nowhere in the history of the house that would show that they were directly informing the real estate agent.
All right. So, and how do you know for sure that it was a meth lab?
Well, the real reason that we have this information is I'm in the military. So we were actually being transferred up here to Oregon as part of my assignment. And prior to that, we had a great real estate agent who worked really close with this whole process trying to get it squared away. Well, the owner who was living in the house pulled my real estate agent aside after the house had closed and said, oh, hey, you got to tell this family with seven kids that they can't live here because this is a meth lab. So the owner himself disclosed it after we closed on the deal.
And by the way, I know people are going to say, because one of the first questions that occurred to me was, did you have a home inspection? And that's where it gets interesting. Home inspections don't check for meth, do they?
They do not, as a matter of fact. And I actually have a statement from the home inspector himself. And it says the Oregon certified home inspectors have never been required to inspect for environmental hazards like methamphetamine use or the manufacturing. This is what his statement is. And he says, we're not even required to inspect for or note anything that about lead, asbestos, radon, formaldehyde, mold, mildew, fungi, or even rot conditions. So that is coming from the inspector. He says they're not required to do that.
And
now, being said, they usually do.
Yeah.
They usually do that. They will, but they're not required to. They will tell you if they see something. But he goes on to further say, he says, I've done 16,000 houses, and I have never seen a mess. House like that. He says, I've never had a house that ever came back as a meth house. He didn't know what to look for. He says it's not part of his job. It's not a requirement.
By the way, thanks for your military service. Let me ask you about some of the other problems of the house that make it tough to move into. One of them is wiring. Now, I know from having gone on a lot of meth raids that methamphetamine labs are often use a lot of electricity. And apparently some of the former tenants in this house had used a rather clever method or creative method to obtain that electricity for their meth lab. What's the story there?
They did, and I didn't know this because I didn't know anything about meth. So you got me up on that one. I had no idea what to be looking for. But what happened is about 3 weeks after we actually owned the house, we were we were living outside. We weren't able to come in the house, but I was trying to figure out how to get wiring and electricity out to the trailers that we were in. And I unplugged one little outlet or one little plug-in out of the outlet. And as soon as I unplugged it, all the power in the house went out. And I said, wait a second, you can't unplug a house. It doesn't work like that. And so I called an electrician and he went through it. It took him about 2 hours, but he finally discovered that they were backfeeding power directly from the power company into the shop. And they ran it underground from the shop into the house, into the main circuit panel. So they were bypassing the meter completely. So it turns out later they were shut down in March. So they had no power since March. The power company had come, shut them down. But when we had it inspected, the inspector checked and all the power was still working and everything. So it starts, again, not a requirement. He's not required to check and see where the power is coming from. He's not required to see if they're illegally stealing power. All the wiring that he could check was completely legitimate. What he didn't see behind the power panel or behind the walls that we found later was that all this was being run through extension cords inside the wall. So inspectors don't rip out walls to see if the wiring's right. So he wouldn't have found that. but they were definitely stealing power through the shop into underground into the house.
How much, Mr. Tubbs, tell me this, how much money would it take to set this house right?
Aha, now that is a much, much more important and difficult question. Depends on who you talk to. So let me just tell you what we've done so far, just to fix the electrical. So the power company came back, they wrote us a letter and said, hey, thank you for catching this. You're not responsible for any of these, the tampering that has occurred. But you cannot put power back in the house until you bring it up to code. And that's where the difficulty comes in, is now it has to be brought up to code to put it in. So that cost me about $50,000 just to put power back in the house.
$50,000? Because what, the whole house has to be rewired?
Well, it has to be brought up to today's standards. Now that they've got the wiring illegally tampered with, they have to put everything back in. So they actually had to put in a whole bunch of, so we are actually living in a place where there's trenches all over the whole place. They had to trench to each of the buildings and move the entire power panel, and had to trace all the lines where all these illegal wiring went. And so it took them took them hours to do all of this, and electricians don't come cheap. So it was $50,000 when it was all said and done that I had this whole thing rectified so that we could at least legally have power in the house.
And yet you're still not in the house again, right?
Correct. That is correct. We at least now have power out to the garage that we're living in and the little trailers that we're living in. So we have that. Now, your second question was, how much is it going to take to fix this? This is where, and this is the whole purpose of the GoFundMe site and the whole purpose of the pressure we're trying to put onto the real estate agency and their insurance, is that, hey, I have gotten all the everything's lined up. I've done everything, all the work to say this is what it legally takes to fix this. For example, as soon as I found out it was a meth lab, I registered with the state of Oregon and got a personnel who were actually involved in the cleanup process that says, okay, this is the steps you must take. And that process just to clean the meth out of the house is about $100,000.
Holy cow.
So that's $100,000 just to clean, because it's not just one house. I have six buildings on this property. So each building was tested. We had 26 different locations tested, and of the 26 that we tested, 26 of them came back positive.
And just to remind folks, the prior owners, including one of the real estate agents involved in the transaction, knew about this but did not disclose it to you.
They did not. As a matter of fact, the real estate agent was the one who filled out the actual disclosure agreement and said, there's nothing else. I have no other information. Now, that gets to the point is, so we're not trying to say that he fraudulently tried to steal this or tried to pull this over. We're just saying it's negligent. You're the owner. You should have known that there was meth in the house. You should have known that they were stealing electricity. You're the owner and the real estate agent, and you filled out all the paperwork. So now, this is a negligent issue.
Ms. Tubbs, how has the insurance company responded? Have they said we will have this resolved by this, such and such a date, or what?
So they have not. That's part of the problem. They went the opposite way. They said, well, we don't really believe you. First of all, you've got your testers and you've got all your results, but we don't believe that. So we're going to bring in our own testers and we're going to bring in our own stuff. And so they've just been pushing this down the line. And we weren't even trying to make it difficult for them. We were just saying, look, this is the cost. We're not trying to raise the price or anything. This is the price it's going to cost. And they brought in their own, and then they started disputing everything. And so it's been a year of just legal wrangling. And my personal opinion is the errors and omissions insurance guys, they know that most families can't handle this kind of situation. So if they can drag it out as long as they can, people will settle as quickly as they can to get something out of this situation. So I personally believe that they're trying to use the time on their side, because the longer they can make it drag out, the more miserable it is for the average person to go through the situation, because the costs just keep going up. And so if they can delay it long enough, then eventually they either give up or they settle for as little as they can just to get something to settle this problem.
Mr. Tubbs, I'm going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll take some phone calls on this, and I'm curious about how this all gets resolved. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've got Travis Tubbs with me, who's in the United States military, comes to the Northwest. His family gets a house. They're thinking, this is going to be the wonderful house that our family, seven kids, mom and dad, are going to live in. And then they find out that the house has been a meth house. And not only that, but would the owner have known? Would the real estate agent have known? Well, it turns out one of the real estate agents was both a co-owner of the house and the real estate agent on the transaction and did not disclose it. Travis, I said I'd take a couple of phone calls. Let's check in first with Bob, who's on the line in Salem. Bob, do you have a comment or question about this story, having heard it from Travis Tubbs himself?
Yeah, and thanks, Lars. And I can't believe it. I was a real estate agent in Arizona for 10 years. And I'll tell you what, that's such a slam dunk lawsuit that I can't believe it. I mean, I was sued for a lot less than that just for letting water come up through the floor. I was supposed to know about it. And, I mean, this was this disclosure, you had the realtor saying that he knew about it, so he knew about it when he filled out the disclosure papers because he warned the people that they couldn't live in it because it was a meth house. I can't believe that he's being jerked around like this when all you have to do is take him to court and say that the reason that you're going through this is because he did not follow protocol by doing the disclosure, and there's an illegal sale to start with. If that actually that house was unsaleable,
Travis,
like years ago when somebody died in a house, you have to disclose it.
Travis, what do you say to that? Have you tried that route?
So we're trying to do this as legally as we can and as easily as we can for everyone. So the problem is, so the one who disclosed it was not the real estate agent; he was the other owner. The real estate agent, there's two owners. The real estate agent, he was the one who filled out all the paperwork, and so he claims he had no knowledge of it. And so it's between those two. They're disputing on who knew what. I really don't care. All I know is that that it was negligence on their part because they should have known that they were stealing electricity and that there was meth in the house.
And
well,
so
he was the professional.
Go ahead. Get a lawyer. Go ahead.
Yeah, the realtor was a professional, and it's his responsibility and it's his due diligence to be to know what's going on. He has to check into that. I mean,
you're exactly right, and I 100% agree, 100%. And so we do have a lawyer, and that's what's taken this whole process so long. And we've been to mediation twice now, and what the errors and omissions insurance guys did, they said, well, we see that it's going to cost $100,000, and we know you paid $50,000, so we'll give you $30,000. And that was how they left it. We said, no, we can't take less than what we've already put in, but they were not willing to negotiate. They weren't willing to do anything. They just said, nope, we're going to stick to this lowest number. And they've just been lowballing it as long as they can, because I suspect the average family can't handle this kind of situation.
No, because right. At some point, you have to have a place to live. And Bob, I appreciate your phone call in. Travis, will you keep in touch with us as developments happen on this? I'm going to reach out to the real estate firm, and I'm going to ask them, how do you plan to set this right? I don't know if they'll come on or not, but I want to ask them, do you think that you did right by this client? And if you didn't think you did right, even if it was after the fact, what are you going to do to set it right at this point? Thanks so much for letting me know about this, and please keep in touch, all right?
I will do it. Thank you for your time, and I really appreciate it. And if anybody is interested in knowing more about the story, if they just type in Google, just Tubbs Tribune, that is where you can...
Okay, Travis, I got to cut it off. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. A little reminder, number one, we're starting a new tradition. Each and every week, we're going to give a Lars Challenge coin to the best naysayer of the week. We've already given one away this week, but this is the first week. And then as we go, we might make an exception on some weeks and give away two. I think we can afford to do that. We have the coins made by veterans in Georgia, and they benefit from those as well. Our Twitter poll today, you can find the challenge coin, by the way, at LarsLarson.com, where you can also find our Twitter poll. Should the law require you to have a driver's license to buy a car? I asked it because of a story detailed in the Seattle Times that talks about a woman whose husband was terribly hurt in a hit-and-run accident where he's crossing a sidewalk, hit by a driver in a car. The driver, 24 years old, but still no driver's license. The car purchased for him about a month before by his mother, who drove the car off the lot. So they went back, the woman whose husband was so badly damaged, brought a lawsuit against CarHop, which is a nationwide chain of used car dealerships. They settled, the dealership or the chain settled for $5.5 million. An attorney who represented the company in the lawsuit maintains the dealership followed the law. CarHop did not hand him in the keys. His mother was the one who drove it off the lot. But still in all, they settled the case for $5.5 million. You can find the Twitter poll, as I said, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Service. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right online at ultimatetruckservice.com. To your cars, calls now, let's go to Richard in Bellingham. Richard, thanks for listening on KGMI. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'm listening to this business about the car dealership paying out the $5.5 million, and we have a situation in our family that's somewhat similar. Mm-hmm. My 14-year-old granddaughter just bought a 79 Camaro Z28. My son had to actually hand the cash to the guy, and my son had to take it to the state, and it's in his name. Now, she isn't going to be driving it. She'll start learning how to drive it when she gets her permit this fall when she turns 15. But what I'm wondering is if she did get in it and drive it,
yes,
and some horrible thing like that occurred, who is the wife of the victim going to sue? The 14-year-old? The special service soldier that sold the car out down in Spanaway to my granddaughter, and he knew that it was going to be her car, mm-hmm, and it was her money. It's just that my son handled the paperwork and technically owns the car. I'm wondering if this 24-year-old's mother didn't have to be the legal owner of the car.
I think she is. No, as I understand it, the Seattle Times didn't say explicitly, but they indicated that mom came to the car lot, indicated, I'm buying this car for my son. She drove the car off the lot, and she apparently had the driver's license and was able to identify. But she told the dealership, the car is for my son. He's going to get a license soon. Well, a month later, he didn't have his license, but he was driving the car and was engaged in this hit-and-run accident where he ran from the scene after hitting this man in a crosswalk. So as far as who gets sued, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. But I don't have a problem with, you know, your situation where you say your son buys a car that's for his girls, but he maintains control of the car, right? And he's not going to let them drive it, as you said. That's sensible. This mom apparently allowed her son in some fashion, either provided him with the keys or wasn't, you know, look, anything I want, I lock up keys, guns, checks, things like that. I lock them up so that you keep them away from kids.
We do, too. The kids' guns are locked up in a safe that they don't have the combination to.
Well, and Richard, my granddaughter has, I bought her a gun on the day she was born, another gun on Christmas, and a gun on her first birthday, and got her a gun for her second birthday. I call them hers, but they're in my name, and they're in the safe, and that's where they'll stay. At some point, I may even, you know, when she's old enough, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, I'll show her how to shoot them, but she still won't own them. When she gets old enough, because of the Looney Tunes laws in both Washington and Oregon, I will legally transfer them to her when she turns 21. But I can't do that yet. But they are for her, but they are not under her control and won't be until she's old enough. I think automobiles are in the same kind of situation. But my question was, as much as I hate the idea of adding new laws, I think we've got we have way too many laws and regulations right now. But I'm wondering, can somebody think, because I usually have some bright idea for how to solve most problems, but how should we solve this when we consider that that car dealership has sold 1,200 cars, according to the Seattle Times piece, to people who are not legally qualified to drive them, meaning they either don't have a license or they have a license that's suspended or revoked. And that's just one dealership of a national chain in the Seattle area. And then I got a call from Lorraine, who's a Seattle cop, nice young lady, who said she stops people all the time who are in no way, shape, or form qualified to be driving a car, and she stops them for driving under the influence. And you wonder, well, how are they getting these cars? Well, in some cases, they're buying them or maybe having somebody else buy them for them. And so, you know, there's got to be a way to stop that problem. And I'm aiming this at the people who are breaking the laws, you know, the ones who are driving where they have no business being on the road.
Well, I'm thinking that the situation with the woman that, you know, did her enabling thing with the boy, and he's a boy if he does those kinds of bad acts. She basically did a straw purchase for him, even though they said that they were going to do that. It seems to me that if the car had legal plates and tags on it, she had to buy them.
Yep.
And it should be in her name because he didn't have a driver's license. Ergo, she's the one that should have been sued.
And the problem is But here's the problem. Most people, you ever heard a lawyer use the term judgment proof? Do you know what that means?
Yes, exactly.
It means you don't have any assets to speak of. You're an average person. Your net assets versus your liabilities is effectively zero, or it's 10 or 20 grand. And you have a 60-year-old man who can't work as an architect anymore. That's worth a lot, because when you can't work for the last 5 or 10 years of your career, that's a gigantic number when you're talking about an architect. He may need, his wife says he's going to need somebody with him 24 hours a day. And right now she fulfills that role. But at some point, you know, she may not be around, and yet he's still going to need to be cared for. So there's a cost there. If you sue the mother and the mother says, you know, my total assets are $20,000 or $30,000 worth of furniture and clothes and personal belongings. And if she bought the car cash, what do you want to bet it was insured for liability, but probably at the lowest levels? You know, so if it's insured for $100,000 in liability, let's say the man got that much. That much to a man who just lost his career as an architect and is going to need 24-hour-a-day care for the rest of his life, 100 grand is a pittance.
I understand that, but what would the wife's possibilities be financially if the mother had bought the car from a special service soldier like my son bought the car for his daughter, my granddaughter?
You go against the dealership.
The woman's out of luck.
She went against the dealership, and the dealership and its lawyers apparently saw enough liability in that situation that they settled for $5 million. That is not a nuisance settlement. That's a substantial amount of money.
I understand that.
So
I just have a sort of a problem with the idea that when lawyers chase deep pockets.
I do too.
Not that it
in general.
Just, it's just I don't like the deep pocket business.
I don't like it either, but I also wonder if it was your wife, Richard, and you knew your wife was going to need millions of dollars in compensation to be made anywhere near whole, and you have a deep pocket available, would you say, because you don't believe in deep pockets, you'd say, "Well, honey, turns out you're out of luck. You're just screwed for the rest of your life"? Or would you go after the deep pocket? When I make it personal, people say, "Well, that's not fair." Usually when you make it personal, you understand why somebody would do that. If it was your wife, what would you do?
I'm an old non-vet, and what I do, that 24-year-old would have some serious problems with me.
I understand that answer, too. I'm trying to think, you know, I'll tell you what, Richard, over the years, I mean, over the last 20 years I've been doing this show, a number of times I've suggested that people should view a car as something that you don't loan to other people unless you are absolutely certain of them. And I apply this to drunk driving. And I've said at times, I wish they had a rule that said every time you catch a drunk, suspended license driver, you simply seize the car. And if the car needs to be returned to the bank that holds the paper on it, fine, hand it back to them. And they say, well, he'll just buy a new one. And that's where years ago I came up with the idea of saying, if you walk in to buy a car and they're going to say, show us your driver's license, your proof of insurance. Well, the guy's suspended. So you say, well, he doesn't have it, so he can't buy it. Well, he'll get a friend to do it. And you make a consequence for that. Richard, what happens? I've never done this in my life, but what happens if I buy a six-pack of beer for some 17-year-old standing outside the Plaid Pantry?
Well, you're liable for what
I've committed a crime. It's a crime for me to buy beer and hand it to these kids, right? Well, should it be similarly illegal if you say, well, I got this friend and he's got a bunch of DUIs and he doesn't have a license anymore, but he really needs to get around, so I'm going to go down and buy a car with his money and then hand it to him, do a straw purchase. Make straw purchases illegal. And if you say, well, that's going to cut off the father who wants to buy a car for his kids. No, it won't, because dad can buy the car in his name and say, I'm going to let my girls drive it, but it's my car till they get old enough. And when they're old enough and legally able, I will transfer the car to them. He can do that.
When they're 18.
Well, he could even do it sooner, because under 18, most dealerships won't let you sign a contract, because no contract signed by somebody under 18 is valid. But if you say, you know what, girls, you did all the driver's ed, you've really been squared away, you've done a year of driving, and you haven't run any major problems, at 17, I'm going to transfer the car to you. A dad could do that, because he doesn't have to worry about a contract. He can say, I'm going to hand the car to you, I will legally put it in your name, and it is up to you to continue to behave responsibly. Or he can say, I'm going to hang on to ownership of it till you're 21 years old, and they may not care about that.
Our 17-year-old grandson also bought a car down in Spanaway, a 77 Camaro, and he has a driver's license, and he's driving it, but his dad owns it.
Boy, you know,
my first
vehicle was a pickup truck, but the vehicle I wanted that I showed my, and I was buying with my money, it was about $900 back then, I wanted in the worst way to own this 1969 Barracuda, and boy, was it a hot car. And my dad said, you are not buying that car because you will end up dead in that car. And I said, okay. And I bought the pickup truck instead. And I was perfectly happy with the pickup truck. But I think about that Cuda sometimes and how much I would have loved. I'd love to have that Cuda today. Thanks for the call, Richard. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I wanted to share this with you. It's written by a young man who identifies himself as a liberal progressive, but I want to give him full credit for writing this. It was a newspaper opinion piece by Oliver Klein. And in fact, I've sent a message to see if maybe I can get Mr. Klein to join us. But I was really struck by his words. He said, I take pride in the progressive political culture. But as a senior in high school, I've noticed a pervasive pattern of progressive peer pressure and self-censorship that is silencing diversity of thought. This new inquisition on the left is dangerous to our most important mechanism of social progress, free and open debate. This is written by a high school student. The ideological monotony within my school is painfully obvious. I'm now entering my fourth year in high school, but I have yet to meet a single student willing to openly declare himself a Republican. Is it really possible that out of 1,500 kids in my school, not a single one even leans conservative? No, it's not. Instead, a number of students have told me privately that peer pressure and their fear of incurring the wrath of today's blasphemy-hunting political scolds has led them to keep silent. Don't get me wrong. I'm not a conservative, nor am I a Trump supporter. But I'd like to be able to talk to one, to debate with one, and to learn from one. However, in an atmosphere where different ideas are met with harsh disapproval, this simply can't happen. Last year, a history teacher at my school was denounced after he published an open letter expressing his belief that, quote, rape culture is a theoretical construct that is ill-defined. His letter spread around the school like wildfire, leading to protests and local news networks picking up the story. Many in the school and the larger community advocated for his termination, and he was publicly shamed for spreading hateful ideas. In any event, condemning and shaming people people won't change any minds. In a culture of stark political polarization like ours, you cannot win people over by demanding that they be punished for wrong think. You change minds with debate, with civil discourse, and through the battle of ideas. You demonstrate your ideas are better by using evidence and reason, not coercion and disciplinary measures. That's written by high school student Oliver Klein. We're going to put the word out and see if we can get Mr. Klein to come on the program and talk about this. That's an intelligent attitude from a liberal progressive high school student that beats the daylights out of some of the nonsense you hear from the political adult lefty adults.